Welcome back to the Bite Me Nutrition Podcast. I am super excited about today's guest. I say that about every guest, but that's because I'm very lucky to talk to a bunch of incredibly smart people. And I've got another incredibly smart person here with me today. I've got Dr. Dean Miller. I've been following him for a while. I can't remember how I came across you, but it would have been something to do with, I think, probably your wearable research and your comments on that, because there's a lot of noise in that space. And I really appreciated the stuff you were saying. It seemed to cut through all of that. And so we'll definitely be chatting about that. But before we do, who are you? What do you do? And why do you do it?
Yeah, no worries. Thanks for having me on, firstly, Johnny. I think the first, I might have dropped into your DMs when I first started my Instagram page, I think, to get some advice on your content, because obviously we know how great it is. So I'm Dean Miller. I'm a sleep scientist, so I have a PhD looking at sleep around athletic populations. At the minute, I'm working at Central Queensland University, but based out of Adelaide, South Australia, basically doing that research on wearables, shift work, jet lag, that sort of area. And I also work with athletes and sporting bodies to recommend sleep practices to athletes that are traveling or going to the Olympics or just day-to-day sleep management. So that's what I do at the minute. And then when I have time, I try to put out some content out there. It is hard, so I'm very impressed with your work. But so hopefully we can cover some nice content today.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, and we'll link to, you know, where to find you at the end for sure. And I think recovery, sleep, in the like athletic populations, I work with some of those, not to the extent that you do, but definitely have even just, you know, regular gym goers. That sounds mean, doesn't it? You know, when people who aren't making a living, and then a lot of young families, and then a lot of shift workers, those are kind of like the three main populations I see. And I mean, I know sleep's important for everyone, but I think those three populations is where it's the most affected. Yep. So I was really excited to ask you a bunch of questions about sleep today and see if we can find any 1%ers that people can apply at home to improve their sleep. But I'm going to start with a very selfish question that's relevant because due to a, I don't know if we even want to call him a colleague, but another large profile on the interwebs talks about having to delay coffee in the morning for, I think it's 2 hours. I think that was the seemingly random window that came up. Do I need to wait 2 hours before I have my first damn coffee of the day, or can I just get up and have a coffee?
It is a bit of a loaded question. So basically, I think the premise of those recommendations from, I guess, a few people who actually put them out now based on a number of things is the cortisol awakening response in the morning. So cortisol is basically associated with stress, but that happens every morning. It's not a bad thing. So in the morning is when cortisol rises, and then it plateaus, and then it goes further down during the day. There is a thought that caffeine first thing in the morning can interrupt this cortisol awakening response or raise it above the baseline levels that you usually would have, causing more stress. So that's basically the rationale behind that recommendation of not having your coffee straight away. Mm. The second point is that the way the coffee actually works, so when you have caffeine in general, not just coffee, there's this molecule called adenosine, or adenosine, that people say in a few ways, that goes into your bloodstream and into your brain. And basically that blocks the receptor site. Caffeine blocks the adenosine receptor site. And adenosine makes you feel tired. And that's why caffeine basically makes you feel better. It blocks the sleepy hormone. And in the morning, if you had a good sleep, you shouldn't have very much adenosine, because while you sleep, it flushes out and you should wake up with very low levels. So the very premise of that mechanism is that caffeine shouldn't have that much of an effect in that context. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying is if you want to have a coffee in the morning, you're running around with the kids, you're having a sip of it, you probably drink it over the first 2 hours anyway. It's not going to ruin your day. So if that's when you need to have your coffee and you need to have your coffee to get through the morning, then by all means do that. If you can wait a little bit, you probably might get more be- beneficial effects of the caffeine. But in saying that, if you're going straight to the gym and you want to get the benefits of a caffeine dose into your bloodstream for performance, then go for it. So I don't know if I'll answer your question there. There'll probably be a theme today where I answer your questions in one or two different ways. But yeah.
That's science, right?
Yeah, exactly.
it depends.
The other thing is also if people want to try this, they can try it out. There's a thing called sleep inertia, which is the thing when you wake up. I don't know if you have a nap in the afternoon and you sleep a little bit too long and you wake up, you feel like you're in next week. That's called sleep inertia. And that should last anywhere from 10 to 30 minutes. And that's not actually related to how tired you are. It's just you waking up, and caffeine's not going to do much for you in terms of your sleep inertia. So if you think that morning coffee is going to fix that, it probably won't. So if you wake up and you just wait a little, if you wait that 30 minutes, if you usually have that coffee, then you might feel good anyway, and then you can have that coffee 2 hours later. So use yourself as the experiment, try a few things. But at the end of the day, if your coffee in the morning is the way that's going to, the best thing for you for to perform or to get your kids to school or to go to the gym in the morning, then honestly, yeah, it's not going to make too much of a difference. And if it does, you will notice that your body will say, no, this isn't good for us.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay. Look, that didn't really confirm my bias, which I'm a bit upset about, but that's good, right? That's what. It sounds like there's potential benefit for, or maybe not so much benefit, but waiting that 30 plus minutes to get outside of that sleep inertia window to actually kind of check in with your real tiredness, because this sleep inertia kind of presents itself as you could have had the most perfect night of sleep, but you're going to feel crummy for 10 to 30 minutes anyway. Is that sort of what that is?
Yeah, usually it's usually associated with which stage of sleep you wake up in. So keeping a regular sleep schedule, you should, if you wake up naturally, which I don't know what percentage of us do anymore, then you should be waking up in those lower stages of sleep, which shouldn't be associated with sleep inertia. That's too bad. But if you, for whatever reason, wake up and you're in that real slow wave sleep, and you have to get up straight away, that's when you're going to experience that sleep inertia, which is a real issue for people like shift workers or people that work on call, firefighters, and that sort of stuff. So that's another piece of research that that's growing as well, how to get rid of that sleep inertia. But that's basically the premise of sleep inertia. So the best way to not have sleep inertia is to have that regular sleep time and wake up.
So, yeah.
Naturally, or you can work out trial and error at what time you usually wake up naturally, and then you set your alarm for that time, even if it's 10 minutes before you want to wake up. You can get rid of that sleep inertia.
Is there potential for caffeine to help pull you out of that sleep inertia if you are woken by someone who's cool, gets woken because they got to put out a fire, or someone like me gets woken because a 2-year-old jumps on them?
There can be a rationale for that. I mean, I think the only issue would be the time it takes for the caffeine to actually take effect might be just as long as the sleep inertia to dissipate. Gotcha. So it could be a double-edged sword in that, once the sleep inertia runs out, the caffeine kicks in and you're happy days. But I don't think it will necessarily get rid of that sleep inertia straight away. There's some evidence there may be some slight evidence for exercise, it's still a bit of a growing area. And outside of that on-call research area, sleep inertia shouldn't affect you too much or be too detrimental for what you're actually doing. People are just usually moping around, unless you're driving straight away when you wake up straight in the car. You shouldn't have to worry about it too much.
Is there is that potentially a bit of a caffeine takes 30 to 60 minutes to spike in the bloodstream, sleep inertia takes 10 to 30 minutes to clear, where maybe associating I feel better after my coffee when it's actually just if you'd waited 30 to 45 minutes anyway?
That could be the effect. So if you now that you're whoever's listening to this might give this a go, they have that knowledge now. they have that knowledge now.
Definitely going to be doing it.
And yeah, if it's 30 minutes and your sleep inertia is dissipated and you feel exactly the same, then you know, oh, okay, I probably don't need that morning coffee. And you could replace it with, I don't know, if you like some sort of tea or a morning drink that sort of starts your morning, that sort of like psychological prompt that, oh, this is the start of the day. You can replace that with something else and then have your coffee a couple of hours in. I usually have my coffee as soon as I start my work day, which probably is an hour or two, but probably 2 hours after waking up. So it can actually fit with your schedule.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. And then just for, so I just realized that podcast is basically an audio medium, and I put my hand up before saying I'm going to give that a crack, I think, because I definitely am, have fallen prey to the get up, you know, often don't get to wake off my own accord. So I feel pretty rough most mornings and grab a coffee kind of when I can, but yeah, be interested to test out whether I'm associating that improvement in mood with sleep inertia. Yeah,
well, I'm with you. And the smell of grinding coffee beans in the first thing in the morning is beautiful.
Oh,
I mean, you could probably still grind them and just leave them there for
just do it.
Yeah. But yeah, no, it is. I think there can be a psychological aspect to it for some people. So if you can sort of replace that behavior with another morning treat, I guess, if you want to call it that.
Yeah. If I don't though. Like, no, this isn't for like my friend. It's more, there might be people who are like, there's no way I'm going to do that.
Yep.
Is there a big risk, or is it more just you're not necessarily going to benefit from that coffee in that moment?
Do you mean in terms of replacing it with something else?
Sorry, no, if someone's like, I'm not replacing it, I'm still having my coffee within 10 minutes of getting up because that's my life. You can't take that away from me. Is there anything we need to worry about there?
I don't think it's going to make it's not going to cause any adverse effects. I mean, the buzzword at the minute is optimal. If I had to choose between you having a coffee first thing in the morning or having a coffee half an hour before bed, by all means, have it first thing in the morning. Yeah. So if you absolutely cannot, and you tried it for a week for an extended period, and you can't do it, then it's not going to result in anything untoward. But if you want to have the best effect of the caffeine based on what we know about its effects, then I'd say try it.
Then wait.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. No, I love that. And I think I definitely am guilty of, because there's this whole optimization out there and it's probably been taken a little bit. I think it's taken too far, and optimization is presented as what should be the goal for everyone. It's easy to almost try and pull too hard in the other direction and not optimize anything. So I think it's good to know, like, this is what our scale is. If you are looking for that last 1%, or this is an area of your life where you do have capacity to change, then yeah, there's probably going to be an improvement, but it's not going to be the thing that makes or breaks your overall health or energy levels by the sound of things. Like, there's bigger rocks to focus on. Is that,
yeah,
is that fair?
It's not, yeah, 100%. It's not black and white. And then, yeah, if you read, that's the main thing about social media content, is that a lot of the statements are quite black and white, in that you must do this, you must do that. And people can actually be quite anxious about things if they don't do it. So this is a good example. Try and do it, even if it's a half an hour wait instead of straight away. It's a spectrum. So you use the context that we're giving you to try and implement the principles as best you can.
Yeah. No one's going to click on that post.
Yeah.
Come on, Dean. Like, yeah. Which sucks, because it's the actual, you know, correct approach. But yeah, people love, they love camps, don't they? They love a binary, you must do this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of answer. But yeah. What can we do? So, look, let's fast forward through the whole day. So we've gotten up, we've gone through our day, we've had our caffeine. I wanted to ask just some big picture stuff about sleep, because I've heard 6 to 9 hours, 7 to 9 hours. I've heard 6 to 8 hours. I think those are probably the main brackets that I've heard for optimal sleep. I've heard plenty of people, I myself have been guilty of saying, like, but I feel pretty good on like 5 to 6 hours sleep. I do wonder if those people probably including me, are just like, don't know what 7 to 9 hours of sleep consistently feels like. So in, are there firm numbers that we can shoot for? Is there genetic variability? And if so, what is that variability and how can I find out where I sit on that spectrum?
Yeah, for sure. Again, context, but the recommendations, as you said, they sort of bounce from 7 to 8, 8 to 9. Anywhere over 7 generally is pretty good if you can maintain that.
Cool.
It's a pretty hard metric to, or requirement to ask of someone just based on daily life. The thing I would say would be low hanging fruit for people is to try and keep their sleep times consistent. Because you could be in bed for 7 hours and they don't overlap. So if you go to bed at 11 usually and you wake up at 6 versus, and then the next day you might go to bed at 9 a.m. and wake up earlier. Our bodies are very rhythmic. So even though you get 7 hours, you might not be getting the same amount of slow wave sleep or restorative sleep. And then you might feel different even though you got the same amount of sleep.
Gotcha.
In terms of people that can function on less sleep, there is a study I always refer to back in 2003. Sounds like a long time ago, but and this is something we tell our students a lot, usually say, oh, that study's so old, but it's a great study. And that's why
a good study is a good study.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah. So yeah. This is why we keep bringing it up. Basically, they sleep deprived people. I think it was 9 hours, 7 hours, 5 hours. And they might've done a 3 hour condition, but that's proper deprivation. But basically what they found is that people maintain their performance on the higher end, so 9 and 7. But as you get to 5, you do see a decrease in performance. But our brain is able to maintain that performance at a lower capacity. So these people obviously went into the lab, they probably had 9 hours sleep beforehand and then got a string of 5 hour sleeps consecutively. So their performance went down after the first 5 hours, but then maintained. So if you're constantly getting that 5 hours sleep, you're maintaining your performance, but it's probably or likely at a reduced capacity to what you would be doing if you were getting 9 hours sleep. But you won't know that because that's just your baseline.
That's your baseline.
Yeah. Correct. With the lower end, it keeps going down. But if you're getting 3 hours of sleep a night, you probably know that you're getting 3 hours of sleep. And then that rebounds pretty quickly as well. So if you go from 7 to 9, it goes back up. That particular study did anyway. So in terms of performance, if someone does say to you, I work fine on 5 hours of sleep, then it's probably just a maintenance of slightly lower performance.
Yeah. And like you said, that's their baseline because that's just what you're used to.
Yeah.
Right. So, and I guess that's also good news for and I think anyone who engages with my stuff or your stuff will know that we're not the optimal crowd. Like we want to give people the tools to optimize if they have capacity, but also we understand that shift work, young families, people on call, all those sorts of things are not going to be able to get a nice, solid, regimented 7 hours every night. But it's good to know that that performance drops, but then maintains, I guess, it doesn't continue to climb across that. And it's also good to know that, so I think you said, once you move out of that 5 hours and get back up into say the 7 to 9 range, it kind of pops back up pretty quickly.
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah. So they usually, when we do those type of sleep restriction studies, we usually do a baseline and then the intervention, so sleep deprivation or 5 hours of sleep, and then a recovery sleep of 9 hours or so, and then suddenly you can see the rebound effect. So if you work a job where you are getting 5 hours of sleep consistently, then you'll maintain that performance. And then if you can get another 9 hour sleep or something after that, you're going to rebound.
Yeah. So can I do that? Can I sleep? I mean, can someone, not just me, this podcast isn't just about me. Can someone say Monday through Thursday, get 5 hours a night and then catch up? Can we sleep bank or what's the research there?
Yeah, you can sleep bank. It's not ideal. If you build up enough 5 hours, it's gonna catch up to you. And it probably there is a lot of inter-individual variability here in terms of 5 hours of sleep for me might be different to 5 hours of sleep for you, and potentially that dip in performance, my dip in performance might be a lot larger than yours. So I would say yes, when you can, try and supplement your sleep with if you can. We've done this with athletes, but there's some research with general population as well that you can supplement your nighttime sleep with daytime naps if you can. So you if you get the same amount of sleep opportunity with a night sleep and an afternoon nap, you get the same amount of total sleep. So if you do have the opportunity, you can do that 5 hours at night and then try and get a couple of hours in the afternoon or supplement that way. But then yeah, if you can only supplement on the weekends, then yeah, definitely do that. What I would say is try to keep your wake time consistent.
Okay. So earlier to bed, but not.
Which doesn't sound very appealing for like the sleep-in squad. I completely understand that. But I think we'll probably touch on it a little bit later, maybe with sleep hygiene, how circadian rhythms work. But getting that sleep before you usually would will make sure that you're not moving your body clock too much, your behaviors. So sleeping in can do
Yeah.
that. But at the end of the day, I'm on team more sleep. So yeah.
Right. So that's like step one,
Correct.
get as much as you can. But then there's ways again to kind of optimize. I didn't know that about, well, I'd heard mixed reports about napping, and I don't know enough about this sort of area to do my own research. And which I need to note, you've literally done your own research, right? You've been involved in a bunch of sleep studies, which is it's awesome to speak to someone in there who's actually doing the research. But so catching up on the weekend, not quite the loophole I was hoping for, but still probably better than just not catching up in general. But napping, a better strategy when able.
I would say so. It is just a safeguard to basically not have an extended period of time where you're getting less sleep than you need. So even if you can get, if you're doing those 5 hours during the week and you can't possibly get any more sleep, and you can do that nap even once or twice that week, it's going to be better than that builds up because if you sleep in for 2 hours on each weekday, a weekend, sorry, each day of the weekend, then that's an extra 4 hours. But if you can sneak a couple in during the week, then that study we actually did
That's not
in
quick.
our lab, the nap study, which was awesome. So we supplemented, we gave them different amount of sleep during the night and then the different amount of sleep during the day. It always ended up being 9 hours total. But there were no
Yeah, cool.
differences at all between the sleep metrics. And that's probably something you'll probably find this interesting, that you see a lot of again tweets or Instagram posts about how we can improve our sleep or change our sleep. In healthy sleepers or healthy individuals, in our lab, we have to do, or we don't very often see a large effect of any intervention in our lab. It's actually quite hard to run a study and see a large change unless you're running a night shift protocol or something where you're sleep depriving them. But yeah, it's actually quite hard to elicit a meaningful change in sleep when you're measuring it as precisely as we do.
So unless you're doing, like you said, the night shift, so something, unless you're aggressively disrupting someone's sleep,
Yeah,
essentially,
correct.
it's a, yeah, okay. I would not have guessed that with napping. I would have been like, nah, it's not as good. Definitely not as good. So there you go. That's why I don't trust my gut all that much. So good news for you nappers out there.
I'm a
It's
terrible
you're
napper, by the
doing
way.
the
So,
right thing.
yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah,
same.
I'm not a great
Yeah,
napper.
I wish.
But if you are, by all means, go for it.
Go. Yeah. So that's a super. What's the word? Why can't I think? I need to have a nap,
Yeah, you do,
clearly.
yeah.
Anyway, it's now all I can think about is napping. But anyway, my son's a great napper, but
Yeah.
I think by the time he's down, I'm like, right, I'll have a nap.
We are recording, or maybe not your time, but post-lunch dip is usually
good time for a nap.
Thermic effect of food. There's a little dip in our circadian rhythm. Yep. Is when we usually get a bit sleepy. So, if we stutter or we can't get a word out, blame the
dip. Yeah. Need a siesta.
That's it. Right?
So, look, let's say that I can't get enough sleep due to work or, shift work, kids, something along those sorts of lines. Napping seems like the first line of defense, trying to catch up there where we can, and then trying to catch up on later days, whether that be the weekend or days off, or if you're a young family, if you can, have different shifts from parents. Is there anything else I can do nutritionally or lifestyle, things I can do during the day, or I guess things that don't involve increasing my sleep hours?
Now, in terms of nutrition, I'll give a shout out to one of my colleagues, Dr. Charlotte Gupta. She does a lot of work in it's actually one of the cooler names of an area, chrononutrition. So she does a lot of work around shift work and meal timings, what makeup of certain foods for shift work. So if you're a shift worker, I definitely recommend searching Dr. Charlotte Gupta on Twitter. There's lots of resources there. Slightly left of my area, but in a rough nutshell, when your body's preparing for sleep, we want it to be preparing for sleep, not digesting a burrito, like a late night burrito.
Yeah.
Or something. So, in terms of get your meal times consistent, and then if you have your pre dinner snack, that's not going to compromise like your sleep in terms of your body's digesting instead of sleeping, I would keep it to a minimum, probably within the 2 hours, 3 hours leading into bed. But again, people have kids, you have other commitments, just try and do your best. Tryptophan rich food, probably people have seen that a bit. We have done a bit of research with Dr. Shona Housen, trying to develop a nutritionally put together sleep drink that helps people sleep. And tryptophan being one of the ingredients, alactobumin, I don't know if I'm saying that right, but it's a protein found in milk, which does have some evidence. So we actually found that it reduced sleep onset latency, which is basically the time it takes to fall asleep. Which lends itself very nicely to the old wives' tale that a glass of milk before bed helps you sleep because that protein is found in milk. So there's varying evidence around different foods. Kiwi fruit, you can have before bed. I usually have that just because I love kiwi fruits too. Skin on.
We're going to have to end it there today, everyone. I'm so sorry.
Controversial.
No.
But yeah, a lot of the stuff around diets, or not so much the content, I won't go that deep just because I guess it's not my particular expertise, that the makeups of the meal, but it's pretty common sense in terms of let your body do what it wants to do when it's going to sleep. That's probably my recommendation. And then obviously caffeine is the big one. We touched on it briefly in terms of the morning, but there was just a recent systematic review, which is basically, for those who don't know, it's a study that collates all the information on a certain topic from other studies that have previously been published. So it's one of the best forms of evidence you can get. And basically they looked at the amount of caffeine people are taking in and how that affects their sleep. And if you're a caffeine lover, don't listen right now, or listen.
yes.
It's not great news. Basically, the general recommendation, and I'll say this under the proviso of there is some individual variability in how people metabolize caffeine, as you would know. But basically, the recommendation is last coffee about 9 hours before bed, 8.8 hours before bed. So not
nine. Oh, okay. That's, yeah.
It's a lot. Yeah. So basically, we're not giving you much of a sweet spot. So 2 hours after bed. So 2 hours after waking up, 9 hours after going to bed, but then for those who love a pre-workout, it's actually worth, it's actually 13 hours before bed is the recommendation. I don't know, that's probably not.
Yeah.
It's probably not feasible for some people that train in the afternoon. And I, as I would say for the other things that we've spoken about, is if it's not affecting your sleep noticeably, and you're having it early enough, that is coffee and pre-workout. Try having less, or try doing less. But yeah, just have that in mind. The pre-workout does have an effect.
Is that because of the higher caffeine dose, or is it the form of caffeine, or is it just the milligrams?
Yeah, it's a milligram. So I think relative to coffee is about 100 milligrams per 250 mil. And then pre-workout is probably, I think it might even be double that.
I've seen a 400 to 500 milligram scoop.
Yeah,
like in some of the crazier ones. Yeah, like it's.
Yeah. So if anyone wants to read that one is actually written by a great PhD student in Brizzy, I think. Brizzy. So Marissa Gardner up at ACU. So that's a very interesting read. It's got nice pictures as well, which it's good for my brain. That's very recent recommendations, only in the last couple months. So sorry, everyone.
No. Well, look, I the other thing I would just say as well, if you are someone who trains in the afternoon and being pragmatic about caffeine consumption, of course, but often what I find is people aren't fueling nutritionally particularly well before they train, and they're using that caffeine hit as a bit of a crutch. So if you feel like you can't live without your pre-workout before every session, that's also probably another bit of a red flag on total volume and recovery and sleep in general and fuel. But I do think that right before you train, maybe have a look at your pre-training nutrition as well, and you might find that you don't need that pre-workout before arms and core, right? okay, that's good. So I guess realistically for most people, that's a soft cutoff or a firm cutoff of around lunch.
Lunchtime coffee. Which I try to stick to. I mean, even as a sleep scientist, I'm not perfect. Sometimes I hit 2 p.m. and I'm like, I need a coffee. I sleep well. So always come back. Whenever you're asking yourself a question related to sleep, if you're a good sleeper, you're not tired during the day, you don't have any daytime sleepiness at all, and you from once or twice a week to once, it's okay. You don't have to stress. But if you do, if you say, I'm going to have a coffee today at 3 p.m. and you are wired, then act accordingly. Because we're all, at the end of the day, we're all N1. So we're all our own experiments, basically. And that's the most important answer, really. So if you keep track of how you're feeling, what happens to you, what you did that day, if you're wired, you can't get to sleep, think about what you did. I had that coffee. Maybe don't do it again.
Yeah, so that is reliable. We are, like, how we feel and our own, we're not going to skew that at all.
Yeah, I mean, listen to your body is probably one of my main things that I say. In saying that, sometimes when we look at subjective measures in research, they can be quite wrong in terms of sometimes we ask people in our lab, oh, how long do you think you slept for? Because they might be blind to the condition, and they say, oh, I slept for 4 hours, I had a terrible sleep, and they slept soundly for 7.5 hours. But if I would say monitor trends. So if you're feeling consistently sleepy during the day when you shouldn't be, and it is hard to tell sometimes between fatigue, whether you're just having a really fatiguing day, or whether you're actually sleepy, if you wake up sleepy. It's a bit of a trial and error in terms of acknowledging how you're feeling, whether that can be related to a behavior during the day or not sleeping well, or sometimes even stress. So I'm giving a layered answer, but I would say your body gives you the most information. So listen to it or learn. I think I was going to touch on this a bit later, but investing in knowing how your body works is a wearable in itself, because this is how my sleep works. last night, this may have been affected because of caffeine. That's probably why I'm not feeling great. And if that is sustained over a week or 2 weeks, then it's pretty good chance that the thing that you're thinking of is the mechanism.
Is the thing.
Yeah.
And that's an important point as well. I guess, like you said, the fact that because there's so many other factors that could be influencing, like you said, it could have just been a big day. You could be stressed. There could be other things. I think don't try it once for one day and go, see, I knew it. That's not the problem. You know, I still feel bad anyway. One thing I've heard is caffeine may not affect people's ability to fall asleep, but can affect their ability to get into those deeper sleep cycles, the more restful sleep cycles. Is that legit or is that?
I don't have a concrete answer on that. In terms of the way I may just have not read that research, but the mechanisms, if you just think of it that way, is so there's two, without getting too sciencey, there's two ways that sleep is regulated. Basically, it's the system we spoke about before. Basically, when we wake up in the morning, the adenosine is building up in our brain, and that's called sleep pressure. Caffeine blocks the sleep pressure for a small period of time. When that dissipates, that's when you get the coffee crash. So it doesn't get rid of the adenosine, it holds it off, and then when the caffeine goes away, it goes.
Okay. It's like a wave.
Yeah, it's a wave. Sort of. So you get hit with all this adenosine, and that's what a coffee crash is. So caffeine is affecting that system. And then the second system is our circadian rhythm. So basically, our body primes for sleep at night. It basically follows our core body temperature rhythm. So as our body's preparing for bed, our core body temperature is going down, probably dips around 3 to 4 a.m. And then goes back up as we wake up and is high during the day. And that basically is probably the main mechanism that controls the makeup of our sleep. So it knows what time of day it is to be getting the restorative REM sleep. So I would without being completely confident in all the research I have read, I would err towards caffeine keeping you awake rather than impacting your sleep stages too much. In saying that, follow the recommendations and neither will be the problem.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Stop trying to find loopholes, Jono. I'm trying, look, most of the loopholes are coming from me, but also definitely the clients who are like, I have a coffee right before bed and I feel fine. You know, it's sort of,
You know. There is also a tolerance level. So,
okay.
There may actually not be a validated answer to that question in terms of people that are really, really used to having coffees. And I know I go out with my wife's grandparents and I'm just about falling asleep at the dinner table when they're having their latte. And I look at, how are you doing that? So there is individual variability. I would just say try not to do that.
I am a healthy caffeine consumer, but the thought of having something around bedtime or after bedtime, I'm like, I can't, can't fathom it. But I think, like you said, those recommendations are there for a reason. Try and abide by them / do that couple of weeks of investigation maybe. Do you get clients or participants to get a journal, like keep some kind of notes around how they feel, their sleep cycles, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, we generally start out with whenever we do a baseline measurement of someone's sleep behavior, we give them a sleep diary and then whatever associated device we might be using to confirm their sleep patterns. If you're not, I'll say this first thing and then I'll give a caveat in that if you're not measuring it, you don't know what's happening. So even if it's just in your diary that you have each day, write down how you're feeling, how you slept. It doesn't have to be hugely scientific. But then on the other end, if you do have a wearable or something that has the capacity to put in your behaviors and how you're feeling, by all means, use it. Try it. If you don't like it, you don't have to do it. So some people love tracking certain variables and some people hate it. So I would say, yeah, try and start. If you're opposed to writing things down or tracking yourself and your behaviors, then literally just write it down on your diary, how you feel each day, or that you had a coffee at a certain time, and start there. And if you want to keep growing that, you can get pretty in-depth with it these days.
Yeah, well, definitely a big bunch of questions I have for you was around wearables, because I know that you've done a lot of research in that space and they're becoming more prevalent. And of course, as technology improves, they're getting fancier and fancier. So can we talk about wearables just in a wearables, or do we sort of need to categorize them? Like, is it not fair to kind of lump them all in together? I guess I would be not talking about the stuff you guys use in the lab. I guess consumer grade, I can walk into a JB Hi-Fi. Yep. Are there still different grades that I should be looking at?
We can use wearables as a term. There are levels, I think, in that the market, listen to me, it's like a economics podcast, but some are a device that you go and you outlay and you buy the device and it comes like that. And then there's other devices where you sign up for a subscription and you get the device as part of the subscription. So that they're all technically wearables. And then there's another layer to that, which I don't think we really need to go into, which is like a partial polysomnography system, which is what we have in the lab, but you can have it at home and just whack it on your forehead. We don't need to go into that, but
yeah, right.
Yeah, we can talk about wearables as a whole, and the different, okay, the different levels, because they're basically doing the same thing, but slightly differently.
Yeah. Yeah, gotcha. And so I guess I've gone into a shop, I bought a wearable. You can mention brands, by the way. I just don't mention any because I don't know any. but I know the big ones. Let's say I've grabbed a wearable. What numbers should I be looking at, or what ones are valid, just what can we measure actually properly? Because from my perspective, I know that total calorie burn throughout a day is not a really valid metric that comes from those wearables. We know there's a ton of variation there, but in the more sleep recovery, resting heart rate, all of the other things I don't understand, what are some good numbers for us to be looking at coming from our wearables?
Yeah, for sure. I'll preface this with the statement that we do, our lab do work with a few of these companies, in full disclosure. So that won't influence my answer at all, because we have done validations on each of them. So basically any of the devices, I guess the wrist worn, the finger worn in the rings, there's a few of them now, so I'm not specifically talking about one of them. They basically use this process called photoplethysmography. Hard to get out, where the little lights that you see on the devices basically reflect into your veins or bloodstream and detect your heart rate. That's the first premise. And then they also use movement to score whether you're moving or whether you're lying down. And the original devices we use, called actigraphs, was just the movement. So we would see, you get zeros and ones whether the person was moving or not. And that's, and that was pretty reliable. So the difficulty with wearables or something that isn't measuring your actual brain waves, so anything that isn't on your head, basically, are assuming a couple of things based on movement and your heart rate. They measure sleep very well. So if you ever see a metric, usually it's called sensitivity to sleep. They're usually high, they're usually in the 90s. But always try and contextualize that around, if I know that you, Jono, sleep for 7 hours a night, and you're a healthy male, and you're probably going to be sleeping for upwards of 90% of that sleep, I can take a pretty accurate guess without putting a device on you for how much sleep you get. So they kind of have a head start in measuring the sleep. The difficulty, and kind of where the better performing wearables are more obvious compared to the others, is the wake. So how well do they detect the wake in between the sleep? So it's hard to tell between restful wake I don't know, watching a movie in bed, reading in bed, and restful sleep. So when you're trying to fall asleep, or when you wake up in the middle of the night and you roll over, that's sort of like, so those, the devices we, well, the, probably the mainstream devices range from 20%, accuracy or sensitivity, or there's a few words that people use, but it doesn't really matter what word you use, 20% to around 60%, accuracy or whatever you want to call it, for wake. So if they're around that 60% mark, it's pretty good. And we've got a validation study, that has six different wearables that we tested. It was a hell of a study to put together, but, that gives you the context. So what I would say is if you have a wearable, you're measuring sleep specifically, then I would say look at your total sleep time, but also look at your sleep timing. I briefly touched on it before because we want to keep that consistent. So try and keep your sleep times at your bedtime constant and your wake time constant. If you have to choose between one or the other, keep your wake time constant. In terms of sleep staging, they're getting a lot better. The better
What is sleep staging?
Yeah, sorry. So basically when we score sleep in the lab, we score it in stages ranging from wake to light sleep. There's a few. So we call it N1, N2, N3, which is slow wave sleep. You might have heard that. And then there's REM, which is the dream stage. Basically what we do is we put all these devices on people with our system. We get professional people to score the sleep. So what happens is we get a registered technician. They go through every 30 seconds of each sleep. It's a lot of sleep. It's very manual. And they categorize each 30-second chunk to N1, light sleep, N2, which is also light sleep, or slow wave sleep, or REM. And then we line up our gold standard and the whatever device it is, and we compare what they're saying at that certain time. And that's how we get those numbers. So when we talk about sleep versus wake, it's wake and all of those stages lumped together. And then when we talk about stages, it's those specific stages. So that's a different comparison. So we're basically scrutinizing the devices a little bit more. The better performing ones run at about 60 to 65% for all the stages, which is quite impressive given that they're just measuring things from the wrist or finger and another person scoring it. And even when you compare across scorers, so people scoring the same PSG gold standard sleep data, we don't get 100% agreement. It probably sits around.
What's the intervariate? Was it intervariate?
It's around around 80. I'm pretty sure. Yeah. So you can't. The wearables will never get to 100. So sitting around 60 is relatively good. In saying that, I don't think you need to take too much notice of it. If you do want to use it, and this could be getting a little bit physiology based, but
nah, do it. Dive in.
if you see a sustained change, for example, if I'm wearing a wearable and I've been getting 15% of slow wave sleep for the last 6 months, and then for a month I'm getting 2%, it may not be completely accurate in terms of your slow wave sleep is changing, but it is detecting a change in your physiology of some sort. Something's changed.
Okay.
It may be completely correct. It's just hard with wearables to validate that. So I would say if you're looking at your sleep stages and they're consistent, happy days, set and forget. Just check your your total sleep time and your the times that you're going to bed. Keep going. So I've worn all the wearables and I check in not every day. If something went wrong or I feel tired, then I'll go back and look. But yeah, I would say look at total sleep time and then move from there. If you're finding yourself, again, another layer of context, but if you're looking at your wearable and you think, oh, I'm not falling asleep as quickly as I'd like to, if it's taking you 20 to 30 minutes or more to fall asleep, then there's a different way you should use the wearable. And this is something is pretty low hanging fruit. So most of the devices now use automatic detection. I don't know if you wear one. So if you go to sleep, you don't have to push anything. Say you're going to sleep, it'll just guess, okay, they've stopped moving. They're going to sleep now. And it's not an exact science, and it's actually really hard to know when someone is attempting to fall asleep.
Yeah, yeah.
So if that's something you want to look at and you want to measure that, I would suggest, and I think most of the wearables do this now, either manually starting asleep. So in most apps, you can go in and you can say, start, I'm going to sleep now. And that gives that anchor point. And then it will give a relatively accurate measure for how long it takes you to fall asleep. If your device doesn't do that, then almost certainly you'll be able to edit your sleep. So if your device doesn't have the prompt to start asleep, write the time down that you actually are going to attempt to sleep and then edit it the next morning. It's a little labor intensive, but to accurately get that answer, that's probably the best protocol to use.
Yeah, awesome. So we want to be paying attention to sleep duration, times of sleeping, like sleep and wake, I guess. We've got that little hack for, that's great for getting some slight, a bit more accuracy around sleep times. A big thing I see a lot is the metrics or the ranking of recovery in a lot of these wearables, you know, ranking your recovery out of 100 or something like that. And I've seen clients and people online just, you know, saying my wearable has said I'm under recovered today. And so I just did a light session. How valid is that?
It's a tricky question. Cause
I'm sorry. Yes, I'm sure it is. So
I knew it was coming.
Yeah.
The problem or the difficulty, I'd say, it's not a problem as such, but a lot of these metrics are proprietary in that the end user doesn't actually know what is going into that number. The companies might give a short description of what they use to punch out that number, but for the most part, it's all proprietary. What I would say is, we did a study with one of the wearables looking at those proprietary metrics for training load, and they do follow the pattern. So obviously these companies are investing a lot of money into this research. So it's not something you discount completely, but if you get one that's saying you're terribly recovered and you're feeling great, the answer is probably somewhere in the middle. I would say, but if you're looking at into the raw metrics, they're probably going to provide more context to that number as well. So people talk a lot about HRV, heart rate variability, which is one of the main metrics that those scores or composite scores will base their result on. If you want to follow a very good practitioner with HRV, Marco Altini. He writes a lot of blogs around heart rate variability. The problem with that metric is a lot of the companies do it differently. So in a nutshell, it's a measure of your autonomic nervous system. So the two systems, the parasympathetic and the sympathetic. So parasympathetic is that rest and digest. Sympathetic is like the stress response. So the higher your HRV, and this is a most important thing, relative to your baseline, the more recovered you should be. So a higher number of HRV shows that there's a healthier balance between the two systems. So the stress, you're adequately armed to respond to stress, but you're also recovering from whatever previous stress that you put the body through, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So that's probably, I would say, look at that first. And then if you want to look at the composite score, you can, but I'd say invest some time into understanding heart rate variability a little bit more. Same with sleep. If you increase your literacy on what these numbers actually are, then you'll be able to adequately respond to whatever feedback you're getting. And then if you need to change your training, I mean, the big piece with these ones, and I think it's probably more of a behavior change tool, is alcohol. When I first started wearing these wearables or using an app like Marco Artini made HRV for training, if people want to use that, if they don't want to buy a wearable, the sensitivity to alcohol is insane. In terms of, I can have one beer on a Friday night, and I know we've exchanged quite a few DMs about low alcohol tips, the beers and stuff, but it'll just tank your numbers, and it makes you want to not drink anymore. I'm not saying don't drink it. It's very telling in terms of what it does to your body, and that gives you a bit of context to how these numbers work and what they're measuring, I guess.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah. So it sounds like I need to go buy some more Nort, the best alcoholic-free beer. Yeah.
Just so not sponsored.
Not sponsored, not affiliate. Oh, man, I say I wish, but I'd still have to say no. But that, of all of the, if a company was to reach out, that would be one of the hardest to say no to, I think. But the feedback I'm getting from those wearables, full disclosure, I've actually literally never worn one, so.
Yeah, and that's okay.
I don't have personal experience with it. So, it sounds like there's good validity in that you want to take notes from it, and you want to but not let it run your whole training, run your whole life. You want to sort of take some prompts and run that through.
Yeah, correct. There's heaps of value in the outputs. And you can use that to inform things to whatever level, but then also still listening to your body as well. Like we, during COVID, we didn't have a lab. So I worked with one of the wearables companies to use those metrics to detect COVID. And it's, the metrics are super sensitive to stuff like that. So we could tell someone, someone had COVID days before they exhibited symptoms. So there's a range, again, it's a spectrum.
Wild.
Yeah, it was a really interesting project. But so if you listen to your body and you can lean on those numbers, I'd say look at the raw numbers first once you understand them, and then you can sort of gauge with the composite scores, the percentages scores, that whether they're useful to you or not. And then just touching on what you said before, if you don't wear a wearable, you're sleeping well, you're training well, you're happy with your progress, you're hitting your goals, you don't absolutely need one. It could take you to a next level. You might love it. Who knows? But don't stress if you don't have one, is basically what I'm saying.
Yeah. Oh, I just hate things on my wrist.
Yeah.
Like, I wish I could wear a watch, because I think watches look cool, but I just don't. And then, like, even I've got a wedding ring, and that's annoying enough to take off my train. So the thought of I'm just a sore. That's really what it is. Like, I haven't ruled it out by any means, but it's good. I think it sounds like, as always, people want, should I just listen to the human or should I just listen to the machine? And the answer is like, well, both.
Yeah. For sure. And then there's another layer to it, in that you're either an informed human or an ill-informed human. So if you don't know how any of these mechanisms work, or how your sleep works, or training loads, or dietetics, or what you're eating, then you're not informed to listen or act. So the best combo would be an informed person with a validated wearable making decisions based on both.
Gotcha. So if I start wearing a wearable that says my HRV is low, but I have no idea how to impact my HRV, that's not super helpful.
Yeah, and then the other thing is with metrics like HRV is there. I might have a really high HRV, and I'm just a local punter. That goes running on the weekends. And then there might be an elite athlete with a lower relative HRV.
The baseline. Yeah.
So it's all about deviations to your own baseline. And I'll say that with most, pretty much all health-related metrics, that's what you should be looking at.
Oh, you think like testosterone, yeah. Right? The amount of guys that stress about testosterone, and then people who have plenty of muscle, plenty of libido and energy and mood, they're on the low, quote unquote, end of the spectrum.
Obviously there's thresholds and things that are medical.
Of course, you get,
for the context of wearables and sleep and that sort of stuff, then it's the deviation up or down from baseline is really where the money's at. Well, not the actual money.
No, yeah. That's the well. Okay, so last question. Sorry, because I'm close to time, but we keep referring to baseline. Mm-hmm. How do I find out my baseline? Like, so with say, if I do start tracking my HRV, how do I know? Do I just let it run for a few months and then can trust that that's my baseline?
You'd want to get an extended period of time, and then obviously contextualize that with what you're doing. HRV, for example, which should be for most people, but if I stop training for a week, my HRV will go up. And then if I'm doing a lot of high intensity work, it might go down a little bit, but you want it to maintain basically for that metric in particular. For sleep, it's a 2-week window we usually get the baseline for. And yes, a wearable that's validated is probably the best way to do that, but you could do it with a sleep diary as well. I would give it at least a couple of weeks. And then ideally, if it's training specific for people, then you would maybe try and do a period of, tapering or like a whatever fits in their schedule. But it's not really, it's not feasible with some people. So I would just say, contextualize things.
So you just want to make sure, I guess, that it's not 2 weeks after the birth of your first child, right. When that project at work is due, or you're traveling or something, is that not going
to
give you
that's a, it and but that doesn't mean you don't have to measure it. You can still measure it, but contextualize that baseline based on what you're doing, and then it's actually a way that you can sort of validate it to yourself if you're going through a real stressful period, I don't know, promotion, or you're having a child or whatever, and then a few months later, things slow down a bit and your HRV rebound goes up relative to what you were, then that sort of validates that, okay, what the protocols that you're using to measure that metric are making sense based on what you're doing, and then providing that context around it. So that's sometimes the low hanging fruit, is adding the context to what you're measuring, and that validates it. Like during my PhD, it was crazy, and I had like a breakdown, not like a mental breakdown, but like physical. It manifested in a physical way, and my numbers reflected that. So it can be a tool, and then you can use it to work your way back up again. But in saying that, you can just listen to your body too.
Yeah. But well, I mean, like you said, I think I can definitely see value in the both, you know, refining the information you're getting from the wearable and running that through that filter of how I feel. Yeah.
And then
I guess like any tool, learning to use
it. Yeah. And then if you're like yourself, Jono, that doesn't like wearing a wrist watch or a ring,
suck it up.
in terms of HRV, obviously the best way to measure heart rate is a chest band. So HRV, the main protocols, prior to the explosion of wearables, and is still used by a lot of athletes, is measuring first thing in the morning. So that would be a way that you could not change too much about your life and still just wake up in the morning, do a 1 minute test. There's apps, you can use your camera phone, put your finger over the camera phone, and that measures your HRV. So that's another. So you can tailor your wearable or your tech tools to not change your behavior too much if that's a deal breaker or something that won't impose too much of a change on your schedule, or whether you want to sleep with a wrist watch on. You would have hated my study when we ran with six different devices at the same time.
I was going to say, was that at once? Was it just like boom, boom, boom?
Three on each wrist.
Stuff of nightmares.
It was one on the forehead and a ring. So we might have excluded you, I think, mate.
Jeez. I definitely would have. I either wouldn't have been accepted or I would have been one of the dropouts for sure.
Fair enough.
Mate, thank you so much. It's been, this is stuff that I'm super interested in, and I think we all should be, right? Because recovery and fatigue management and sleep hygiene and all of the things, like I know we started with a bit of a joke around people communicating very black and white facts about sleep, but I think one of the indisputable things is it's very important, right? So it's really interesting to find some little hacks, the nap thing. Maybe I should revisit that and try and get better at napping, because that's great. And all of the wearable discussion.
Try the Nappuccino. Everyone loves this one. There's limited evidence. If you struggle with napping, this might be a way to incentivize it. Early afternoon proviso, but have a coffee, nap for 20 minutes. By the time you wake up, the coffee will kick in, get rid of your sleep inertia. So you can have a go at that one if you want to.
it's another excuse to have a coffee. So you're right. That is a good incentive. So yeah, another hack. And then all the wearable talk, there's a lot of noise out there about them. So it's cool to figure out what is relevant and useful and how to, again, I think, like we said, it's a tool. So learning how to use that tool is really awesome. So if people want to learn more about you, about the work you're doing, about the studies you've discussed, I'll put all the studies that we've discussed in the show notes on the website, so you can go click on all of those. And I'll, of course, link up to where you can find Dr. Dean. Dr. Dean, we're going to call you Dr. Dean. cool. Find where you can find Dean. Where's the best place that people want to engage with your content and your research?
So I'm on Instagram and Twitter, probably more on Twitter. I'm trying to find more time to do the Insta stuff, but just Dr. Dean J. Miller. If you want to go into a bit more depth in terms of the research articles, if you want to dive deeper, obviously Google Scholar or ResearchGate, you can just type in Dean J. Miller. I'm the only one. That's why I put the J in there. So if you want to dive a bit deeper, you can a Google search should suffice. Otherwise, I'll try to get some more stuff out on Insta for you guys.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah, I'll link the Twitter, I'll link the Insta, I'll link the ResearchGate, and we'll link those studies in the notes. But Dean, thanks so much for coming on today, mate. It was a blast. I got to ask you all the questions that I wanted to ask you, which is really all it's about, right?
No, it's great.
Awesome. Thank you. And thanks, guys, for listening. I'll chat to you next time.